is ready.
May it please the court. The board made the same claim construction and obviousness errors that we discussed in connection with the 2092 appeal in all of the IPRs underlying both of these appeals. I don't plan to revisit those unless there are additional questions. Instead, I'd like to focus on the 2239 appeal because it raises a third error independently requiring at least a remand of that IPR. Even if Qualcomm's claim construction, the board's claim construction, is applied, the board's finding that the Uehara prior art reference fails to anticipate the claims of the 356 patent is unsupported by substantial evidence. The Uehara prior art reference discloses what's referred to as a dual carrier signal, and it describes a signal in which data is encoded around two different carrier frequencies. The British application, that is the very prior art reference that the board relied upon to justify its very narrow definition of carrier aggregation, expressly states that a dual carrier signal is the same thing as carrier aggregation. It was error for the board to ignore that. To show your honors that error, I will ask that you turn to three specific portions of the appendix. The first is JA1179 in the 2239 appeal. And that shows paragraph 47 of the Uehara prior art reference. Page 47 describes an amplifier circuit that, quote, describes a signal that may include two channels encoded around two different carrier frequencies.
I'm sorry, Mr. Lanthier, did you say AA179?
1179, Your Honor, yes. Of the appendix for appeal number 2022239.
Okay. And this is the Uehara reference.
This is the primary prior art reference for those IPR petitions, and we called it Uehara. I believe that that all the parties agree that's the correct pronunciation of that inventor's last name. And in particular, I'm trying to point the court to paragraph 47 of the Uehara prior art reference, and that's at page 1179 of the appendix.
Okay.
It states that the carrier signal that's received by the Uehara receiver architecture may include two channels encoded around two different carrier frequencies, parentheses, i.e. dual carriers, for example. And it refers to that as a single signal. It says the signal can include two channels encoded around two different carrier frequencies. The second, and let me make one small point here because it was such a focus of Qualcomm's briefing. Paragraph 47 of Uehara is discussed extensively in our petition. Qualcomm first came up with the single virtual channel limitation in its patent owner response. So that was after institution of the IPR. So we could not have used that terminology at the time that we filed that petition. In fact, Qualcomm had proposed a claim construction to the ITC that it now says is unreasonably narrow, because in the ITC, it just said that carrier aggregation is simultaneous operation on multiple carriers to increase bandwidth. But then in this patent owner response, it introduced the single virtual channel. The second portion of the joint appendix that the court, I respectfully ask, take a careful look at is joint appendix page 2716. And this is a portion that's the front page of the prior art reference that the parties and the board have referred to as the British application.
27 what?
2716, Your Honor, 2716. And the last sentence of text that you see on the cover page of the British application says, carrier aggregation mode is also known as spectrum aggregation mode, dual carrier mode, and dual cell mode. So remember, Uehara discloses receiving dual carriers. The British application says dual carriers and carrier aggregation are the same thing. The board's determination that Uehara fails to anticipate is irreconcilable with this evidence. And if we turn to the third portion of the appendix that I would ask your honors to focus on, that's appendix pages 22 to 24, we see that the British application is the very thing that the board used to justify its construction of carrier aggregation and its addition of the single virtual, combined as a single virtual channel limitation that it imported into the construction of carrier aggregation. It cannot be right that the British application is what supports finding what carrier aggregation is from a claim construction perspective. It says that dual carriers is the same thing as carrier aggregation. Uehara discloses receiving dual carriers, but Uehara, as the board found, does not anticipate. The board did not address this, although it was clearly raised in our briefing to the board on this topic in its final written decision. And I will note that Qualcomm did not address this in its briefing, which you'll find at pages 50 to 53 on this topic in its brief. Unless your honors have questions, I would reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
I have a question. Does Uehara disclose increased bandwidth?
To the extent that the answer from the board's perspective is yes. The board relied on, does Uehara disclose increased bandwidth? Yes, because it discloses that you can have a signal in which there are two channels simultaneously broadcast. That is under the Qualcomm and the board interpretation of what it means to increase bandwidth. That is increasing bandwidth. Because what Qualcomm and the board have said is that what carrier aggregation does is it takes a single transmission, puts it on two different carriers, encodes around two different carriers, and transmits it. And therefore, you increase the bandwidth in the sense that whereas before you were limited to the bandwidth of a single channel, now you are transmitting over two different channels and therefore have increased bandwidth. That's their theory, and that's how the board justified the increased bandwidth limitation that it added into the claim.
Any more questions at this stage? Okay, we'll save your rebuttal time. And Mr. Mayor, go ahead.
Good morning, Your Honors. First, I'd like to speak to the anticipation obviousness arguments with respect to Uehara, and then I would like to turn to the Section 315 cross-appeal. With respect to Uehara, Intel's anticipation argument here relies on attorney argument regarding the carrier aggregation limitation. Intel cannot point to any evidence in the joint appendix where its expert, Dr. Fay, who submitted a rebuttal declaration, testified that Uehara extends bandwidth by combining carriers as a single virtual channel. There's no evidence from Intel's expert that Uehara's reference to dual carriers actually teaches combining carriers into a single virtual channel.
I assume Intel cited to this passage in column 4 of Uehara in the IPR below trying to explain why this dual carrier, whatever that is a single RF signal having two channels encoded around two different carrier frequencies, i.e. dual carriers. So why isn't therefore Uehara's dual carrier mode. That's the term it uses, right? Dual carrier mode?
Correct. Uehara says dual carrier. Correct.
Okay. Why isn't Uehara's dual carrier mode the same thing as carrier aggregation?
Because, and the board noted Intel's reliance on paragraph 47 of Uehara throughout its opinion, and what the board found in substantively engaged with Uehara is that Uehara simply teaches receiving multiple transmissions on different carriers. It does not teach aggregating or combining those carriers together.
Well, I know that's what the board said, but I'm trying to understand the board's analysis of this particular quoted sentence from column 4 that was relied upon by Intel. And now I'm curious as to what the board said about it. Maybe it said nothing. But if it said nothing about it, then what is the response to it? What is the merit-based response, especially when we have the last sentence of the abstract for the so-called British application, which seemingly equates carrier aggregation with a dual carrier mode, which is the very thing that Uehara is talking about, a dual carrier mode.
So, Your Honor, let me try to address that. On page 32 of the appendix, the board cites and acknowledges Intel's argument regarding the dual carrier mode. On pages 33 and 34, the board sets forth its analysis as to why Uehara's dual carrier mode does not anticipate the claims under the board's construction. And I think it does a good job on page 34. The board explains Uehara's carriers are transmitted, received, and processed at the same time. At no point are they combined or bonded together as a single virtual channel. So what Intel's argument is no more than what the claim language recited before the claims were amended to add carrier aggregation. Uehara teaches transmissions sent on multiple carriers at different frequencies. That is a separate limitation from the carrier aggregation limitation here, and that's what the board found.
So how would you persuade me that what the sentence on column 4 says doesn't really mean what it says?
Well, the sentence on column 4 in Uehara says you are receiving multiple transmissions on different carriers. And the encoding part is simply that's not carrier aggregation. Encoding is how the data is put on the carriers. But nothing in that sentence teaches combining or aggregating those carriers into a single virtual channel.
What about the reference to an RF signal?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And the claims already, if you look at the claims here, an RF signal, the claims before they were amended in this case recited an RF signal, singular, comprising transmissions, plural, on multiple carriers at different frequencies. So you can have an RF signal that has multiple transmissions, but those transmissions aren't combined together. They're not aggregated. That what Uehara does is no more than HiRoad did. It doesn't teach carrier aggregation.
Okay. So what about the British application abstract?
So the British application abstract
appears to equate dual carrier mode with carrier aggregation mode. Is that a correct understanding of that sentence or not?
I don't think it is, Your Honor. It identifies different terms, and dual carrier is one of them. But importantly, that is the only time in a British application that you will see dual carrier and carrier aggregation. Carrier aggregation is used elsewhere in the British application several times. It's not equated to dual carrier. It's called spectrum aggregation. But even beyond that, what the board did here is...
So saying it once is not enough? A reference needs to say these two things are equal multiple times for it to count?
No, but I think it's suggestive that dual carrier is not necessarily synonymous with carrier aggregation. And beyond that, the board did more than a...
Why isn't it? Why if the sentence said, when I talk about carrier aggregation mode, I'm also talking about dual carrier mode. If it said it like that, that would be pretty clear to you, right?
If it said it like, if
the author of this document, am talking about carrier aggregation mode, I'm also talking about dual carrier mode.
That would be an equation of the two in the British application.
So if it said carrier aggregation mode is also known as dual carrier mode? Would that be good enough?
In that context, yes, but it would also be necessary to examine the substance of what those references are talking about. And that's what the board here didn't rest on a word match between the British application in one reference and Uehara in another. The board looked at the substance of Uehara's disclosure, what Uehara taught as dual carrier, and found that in Uehara, dual carrier did not disclose combining multiple carriers together to form a single virtual channel.
Did Intel make this connect the dots argument below between the last sentence of the abstract of the British application and column 4 of Uehara to justify its position that Uehara's dual carrier mode is in fact carrier aggregation mode and therefore does anticipate Qualcomm's claims?
It did, Your Honor, in its reply, and I think the board notes that in its final written decision at page 32. But what was missing from Intel's proffer of proof is even its expert did not testify that there is a single virtual channel in Uehara.
What does single virtual channel mean to you?
It is when you combine multiple carriers or component carriers together such that they can be treated as one large channel or one large carrier, as opposed to discrete carriers, such that you can have one piece of data being sent simultaneously on multiple carriers at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And I would also like to note, Your Honor, with respect to obviousness, Intel alludes to that, and I think I want to make one point. Just like Lee and Uehara, the board did explain on page 41 here that there was a failure for motivation to combine because the petitioner did not argue that one of ordinary skill in the art seeking to employ carrier aggregation would have turned to Uehara because Uehara's circuitry would have allowed for power conservation or any other benefit. The board made the same finding with respect to Lee that we discussed earlier. What I would like to do now, Your Honors, is, if I may, is turn to Section 315, cross appeal.
As I understand your red brief, this is a conditional cross appeal in the sense that if we were to affirm the board's findings and therefore reject Intel's challenges, 102, 103, et cetera, in its blue brief, then you waive this cross appeal?
If the court affirms the board's findings, correct. It's a conditional cross appeal, yes. In the event this court doesn't affirm on the board's final decision, the court should dismiss these appeals because Intel was stopped from maintaining these IPRs after a final written decision issued in the 2092 appeal. Section 315(b)(1) is clear. When a petitioner's IPR results in a final written decision on a particular claim, the petitioner may not maintain IPR proceedings on the same claim based on any ground that the petitioner reasonably could have raised. Here, when Intel filed the petition in the 2092 appeal, there is no dispute that Intel was aware of the prior art references in these IPRs. These references were IPR eligible, and Intel was not statutorily precluded from raising those grounds. As a result, Intel could have reasonably raised these grounds. Now, Intel and the director's arguments are immaterial, and they misread the statute. Contrary to Intel and the director's view, Section 315 is not concerned with a merits-based evaluation regarding the likelihood of institution of those grounds. Section 315 states, are there grounds that reasonably could have been raised, not whether grounds that reasonably could have been
right. And just to accelerate the conversation here, both Intel and the patent board are saying, well, at the time of filing this particular petition, which you want to stop them from maintaining now, they could not have raised these particular grounds because they had raised those very grounds the day before in its earlier petition. And so therefore, it was actually barred from requesting that particular grounds. As I think, am I summarizing their argument correctly?
Well, my reading of their argument is not that they were barred, but it's likely or it's a possibility that the petition could have been rejected. And Section 315 doesn't concern itself with whether a ground could have been rejected or instituted. It's whether the ground could have been raised. Here, there's no dispute that the ground could have been raised. Whether it would have been instituted or otherwise successful is not the concern of Section 315. And Intel and the director's arguments focus on whether it would have been instituted.
I'm getting confused now. Is your argument that they raised ground X in petition one on day one, and then they could have and they should have in their IPR petition number two filed on day two, petition for not only a new ground, like ground Y, but also repeated the ground X that they had already filed the prior day in IPR petition one?
They could have raised it, whether it would have been the right thing to, whether strategically it was the right decision.
I mean, that doesn't make any sense, right?
Well,
nobody would do that.
But, Your Honor, it's not whether they would, it's whether they reasonably could have raised it.
Right. As I was, your argument is more during this time frame, before Intel filed all these different petitions, Intel knew about all these different references. They knew about Lee, they knew about John, they knew about Uehara, and so they really needed to roll them all up into a single petition, or if they were going to chop up all these different grounds into different petitions, they needed to move to consolidate them all to ensure that no one IPR would reach a final decision before the other IPRs did in order to avoid the possible outcome of estoppel.
Correct. Or they could have gone on a claim-by-claim basis as opposed to a prior-by-prior art basis. They could have done any number of things to avoid estoppel. That's correct.
Counsel, this is Judge Reyna. When in the time frame would estoppel actually apply? Does it apply upon the issuance of a final written decision, or does it apply after all appeal rights have been exhausted?
The statute, Section 315E1, makes clear that it applies after final written decision, and I think this court's Network 1, the HP case, echoes that. Estoppel is effective upon an issuance of a final written decision.
We're talking about as soon as the final written decision issued in what I'll call, the Lee IPR. Did the Lee IPR come out first?
Yes.
Okay, so as soon as that final written decision came out, you were within your rights to seek a termination of Intel from these other IPRs. And you didn't need to wait for all possible appeals to be exhausted of that final written decision in the Lee IPR before you could legitimately seek termination of Intel from the Jian IPR and the Uehara IPR. That's what you're talking about, right?
Correct, yes. I think the statute speaks to that, as does the Network 1. Correct, Your Honor.
What about our case in Vernetix versus Apple? Are you familiar with that?
I've read the case, but I'm not enough to anticipate your question, Your Honor.
Basically, we said that estoppel applies when all appeals have been terminated.
The death.
It was a question of finality in the context of estoppel, these type of issues we're talking about.
And so, Your Honor, I apologize. I don't know specifically, I want to ask you a question, but did that case involve inter parties review?
I don't think it did, no.
Okay. And I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't mean to flip the script. The reason I ask that is because under Section 315E1 in the IPR context, the statute is clear that it's upon issuance of a final written decision.
Okay, because this issue has come up in other instances, you know, and it's a live issue, and I was interested in the thoughts of all counsel here.
And I know in Intel's brief, there's reference on inter parties reexamination, and that the estoppel effect took place would have taken effect differently there because the statute was framed differently, and it does not parallel Section 315E. If there's no further questions, Your Honor, I'll reserve any remaining time for rebuttal.
Yes. Okay. Yes, you have rebuttal on the cross appeal. All right. Then we'll hear from counsel for the appellant, Mr. Rantier.
Thank you, Your Honor. Unless the court would prefer otherwise, I'll go back and start with the appeal and the issue of Uehara and its teaching of a dual carrier signal. Judge Chen, you raised the question, did Intel and did its expert advance this position before the board? The answer is yes. One site I can refer you to is appendix page 1725, which is Dr. Fay's declaration there.
It's more helpful for me to actually know about your petition sites. There's a lot of things experts say in their declarations that fall by the wayside, and we don't really expect the administrative patent judges to review all of that when the petitioner chooses not to rely on all of that.
Yes, Your Honor. So it is also in our reply submission, and that would be at appendix page 3,700. It's at page, and I apologize for that, Your Honor, it's page 3,798 in particular. 3,797, by mistake. And you can see there, under the subheading C, specifically, we did advance in our reply that even under the new claim construction that had been first proposed by Qualcomm in its patent owner response, this one with the single virtual channel, that the Uehara reference would teach it because the British application specifically equates carrier aggregation mode and dual carrier mode. And Uehara at paragraph 47 discloses the receipt of a dual carrier signal.
Did your expert testify to this? That
yes.
When Uehara is talking about dual carrier mode, it's necessarily talking about what the board understood to be carrier aggregation.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's at appendix page 1725.
1725. And did you cite that in the reply too?
I expect we did, Your Honor. The answer is yes. I need to line up the paragraph numbers from the declaration to see whether it's the citation to paragraph 91 or paragraph 38. I believe it's the citation to exhibit 1039, paragraph 38, that you see at the bottom of appendix page 3797. But, Your Honors, I'd like to focus on how unfair what's happened here is. The 356 patent the 356 patent nowhere discusses a single virtual channel or what happens to component carriers after they are amplified by the LNAs. All the 356 patent does is use the term carrier aggregation, and then that term is bootstrapped by the board to import all of this, all of these requirements about what happens to the signal after it's amplified in terms of combining the single virtual channel. So then to turn and say, well, but Uehara doesn't anticipate the claims of the 356 patent because it doesn't explain anything about combining as a single virtual channel in those specific terms is very unfair, because what Uehara says is, we're going to talk about carrier aggregation. Carrier aggregation is the same thing as dual carriers. And so if it's good enough in the 356 patent to just use the term carrier aggregation and import all of these requirements about increased bandwidth in a single virtual channel, then the same has to be true, that the Uehara uses dual carrier. The British prior art reference that the board relies upon specifically equates carrier aggregation in dual carrier mode. That has to be enough for anticipation. Now, Your Honors, I said I wouldn't go back to the obviousness question, but I felt very badly, Judge Chen, that I didn't give you the right record site for where in our petition the discussion was of the reasons to combine with the feasibility study.
Are we talking about the prior appeal?
I'm going to give you a reference in this appeal. It's the same, but I'll give you the one in the prior appeal as well. In this appendix, Your Honors, it's in appendix pages 3584 to 3587. In the 2092 appeal, it's at pages, the 129 petitions discussion is at page 5083 to 5086. And your copy of the joint appendix does not have that particular portion of the petition from the 00128 IPR. We cited the Dr. Fay's declaration, but it is there in the portion of the petition from the 00129 and 00128 are the same. The final point is, I'll turn to the cross appeal briefly unless there are additional questions on our appeal. And when counsel for Qualcomm made his argument and he referred to the statute, I think that he omitted the most important words, probably the four most important words for purposes of the cross appeal. Three of those words are that what the statute says is a petitioner is stopped for, after a final decision issues, a petitioner is stopped from raising any grounds that it raised or could have raised, quote, during that IPR. That's in the statute, during that IPR. And as this court found just on Friday, during that IPR means at the time you filed your petition, could you reasonably have included the prior art grounds? Here we're talking about petitions that were filed on November 9th, 2018. On November 8th, 2018, I'm sorry, we're talking about petitions, yes, that were filed on November 8th, 2018. On November 9th, 2018, the lead petitions were filed. So when the statute talks about that petition, it's referring to the lead petitions. And having filed identical grounds on November 8th, Intel could not reasonably have refiled the exact same grounds on November 9th. The board's determination that Intel could not reasonably have re-raised the identical grounds on the next day is correct, and that's why the cross-appeal should be denied.
So under that understanding, it allows, it endorses and condones permitting an IPR petition to get more than one bite at the apple. And my understanding of this entire process and the reason why we have an estoppel provision is you allow a party, such as Intel, when they want to attack a patent, to get one shot at it. And after that shot is over, and here by statute it's when the final written decision is released, And that's it. They can't maintain or request any other challenges that are currently pending against that patent. And so it seems odd to me that we would allow the whims of how the patent board operates in terms of the patent board's timings about relative co-pending IPRs to control whether a party is estopped. And in some instances, like what you have here, is allow the challenger to keep going with a second IPR. I mean, that doesn't really make sense in terms of what is the principle, the underlying core principle of why we have this statutory estoppel provision.
Your Honor, respectfully, that's the opposite of what happens here. And
everything I say is the opposite of what
happens. Well, but it's just the date issue, Your Honor. If we had filed, let's say, the lead petitions on September 1st, and then followed up and filed these petitions on November 1st, there's no debate, and we don't disagree, that when the final written decision issued on the lead petitions, there would be an estoppel against Intel maintaining the subsequent IPR petitions, assuming that there wasn't some idiosyncratic reason why Intel couldn't reasonably have been aware of the prior art in the later petitions on the date that it filed the earlier ones. Here, though, what happened was we filed on November 8th these petitions, the ones that are at issue in the cross appeal, with the prior art for Uehara and Jian Zian. And then on November 9th, we filed the lead petition. We weren't trying to game anything. We filed those petitions very close in time, less than a day apart from one another. And only because the patent office at paralegals happened to docket the earlier filed petitions far later was there an issue here. We are not advocating a rule that would allow anyone to get a second bite at the apple. And remember that at the time that these IPRs were filed, Your Honor, and this is not true today, it was routine and it was encouraged by the Patent Office for parties to file multiple petitions challenging a single patent. Now the rule has changed, and the Patent Office has a presumption that you should only file one petition.
Did you have some guaranteed right that all of the final written decisions across all of the IPRs that you filed would be issued on the same day? And I don't think you had a right to that.
You didn't ask for that.
You didn't ask for a consolidation of all the IPRs. So, I mean, I think you were on notice that any one of these decisions could have issued first.
Your Honor, that's not, I guess it's theoretically possible, but because of the statutory requirement, the timing requirements for IPR proceedings, once the earlier filed petitions were docketed 6 weeks after the earlier filed petition, realistically, there wasn't a way to consolidate the proceedings because the due dates would have been too close. You'd have to compress down everybody's time to respond to one another's submissions, including the patent owner's time for the patent owner response. But also, while I guess it's theoretically possible that the board would have issued a final written decision in these 7 or 8 weeks earlier than it needed to,
Let's hear, if the panel has no questions other than in this area, let's hear from the intervener.
Judge Newman, I did have a question I wanted to ask.
Proceed, of course.
And that is, counsel, when you refer to the statute here, are you talking about 315E1?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
Okay. And that makes it clear that the trigger for estoppel is a final written decision, right?
But Teresa,
I thought that statute applies only to petition or IPR that results in a final written decision. It doesn't say when estoppel is triggered. Only...
I apologize, Your Honor. I thought you were asking...
The clarification is that Vernetix was a PTAB case, but it was pre-AIA, so it wasn't dealing with the statute at the time, which now it is.
Yes, Your Honor. So my answer was to a slightly different question. I thought you were only asking about whether the during that IPR language came from 315E1, which it does. The separate question of what the timing is for an estoppel requires a reading of both Section 315 and Section 318, which we set forth in our brief. And we do, the court specifically held open the issue of when the estoppel applies in the progressive casualty case. I think it's a little bit academic here because what the estoppel is it's an estoppel against a party maintaining an IPR proceeding after the estoppel takes effect. And the facts here were that at the time that the final written decisions on the leave petitions, the later filed petitions, were issued, we had already had the oral hearing on the petitions we're discussing here with the cross appeal, the Uehara and the Jian and Jian petitions. And so Intel didn't need to do anything further. At that point, all that was happening was that the board was issuing final written decisions. And so I think it's a little bit academic in a sense as to when the estoppel applies in this case, because as we and the PTO agree, regardless of whether Intel continued to maintain its IPR, the board had the authority to carry forward and issue the final written decision.
Okay. All right, thanks.
Any more questions for Mr. Lantier? Okay, then let's hear from the intervener and explain the estoppel to us.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, and may it please the court. With respect to this estoppel issue raised by Qualcomm, I'd like to make two main points. The first is that the plain language of the estoppel analysis under Section 315 includes looking at more than whether just petitioner knew of a ground. And second, that the board properly applied the statutory language to the very unique facts of this case and found no estoppel. So with respect to the plain language of the estoppel, it involves more than just a knowledge test that would foreclose inquiry into any and other facts that would weigh on whether a petitioner could reasonably have raised a ground. And that's because the plain language of the statute says reasonably could have raised, not reasonably could have known. Second, the statute asks whether you reasonably could have raised it in the IPR reaching final written decision. And so that's not whether or not you could redo the entire strategy of your case. The statute specifically asks, can you raise those grounds in the IPR that reached final written decision? And that's important in this case because there's been a number of different strategy, different options offered in the discussion so far today regarding raising things as a single petition, raising things on a claim-by-claim basis. And while sometimes in the mine run cases, that is an option. If you had a case where you could have just, instead of filing your second petition, you could have put them all together in one petition and not filed that second petition, then you reasonably could have raised it. Here, this is not like the typical case. Here, the IPR that reached final written decision is the second filed proceeding. If you say we could have filed it all in a single petition, that essentially means getting rid of the petition that we're actually looking at. So we're looking at the petition that was second. If we're saying we'd follow them all together, that's basically saying we're eliminating the second petition, which just doesn't make sense. Similarly, if you say, oh, you should have raised them all on a claim-by-claim basis, again, this is a second petition filed. You had already filed a petition. If you say you should have done your second petition on a claim-by-claim basis, now we're going head-on into the idea that you would have raised repetitive grounds, which the board found unreasonable, and Qualcomm does not dispute that it would have been unreasonable to raise redundant grounds in a second petition. Back to the statutory language, in addition to being focused on what you could raise, what you could raise in the IPR reaching final written decision, the statute also has this reasonable modifier. And I think that addresses the issue that Qualcomm raised, that 315 is not concerned about what could be instituted or what, it's just what you could do. And that essentially eliminates this reasonable modifier. It says, Qualcomm is asking the petitioner to do everything that is physically possible. Could you do it? Not whether you reasonably could have done it. And we say that because you have this reasonable modifier, it takes you away from just what is physically possible, but instead you look at to what a competent practitioner could have raised reasonably. And here there's no dispute, and in fact I think Qualcomm's counsel said it wouldn't have been a great strategy to put them all repetitive in the second IPR. With respect to Judge Chen, you raised the issue of consolidation. That is one way that a petitioner reasonably could have raised a ground in the IPR reaching final written decision. However, again, the existence of consolidation itself, the physical possibility that the board can consolidate, does not mean in every case you reasonably could have raised grounds by consolidation. And that's because consolidation is a case-by-case analysis. Sometimes the board grants consolidation, sometimes they deny it. And here, when Qualcomm moved to terminate based on 315e estoppel, they did not establish that consolidation was likely, that it was reasonable. All they said was, it's an option. It's out there. And
it seems very peculiar to me that the estoppel provision is designed to constrain challengers to one bite at the apple for a given patent claim, except for peculiar circumstances like this. Then you get to have two bites of that at the apple, or here, in fact, three bites at the apple, all based on the two IPR filings being one day apart as opposed to being filed on the same day or something like this. It doesn't really make any sense to me. And like I said before, it permits the whims of the PTAB's own, you know, idiosyncratic processing to control the outcome of estoppel, when what should control the estoppel is once there's a final written decision, it cuts off all other pending challenges. Assuming that back in the day, the challenger knew about all of the different possible grounds, but for whatever reason chose to chop them up into different petitions, and whether they were filed on the same day or filed one day apart, it shouldn't really make any relevant difference. That's the concern I have here with what the PTO is trying to advance. When the PTO has already argued that when IPR's petitions happen to be filed on the same day, of course, you're going to get estoppel barring any still pending IPRs when a final written decision issues in one of the IPRs.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I understand your frustration. This is a very unique case. And I think here it reflects the idea that
it doesn't have to be a unique case.
Well,
it can be like all the other cases.
I think what happened here is that the board, because of the difference in this case versus all the other cases, for example, the intuitive case that's still pending before this court regarding same-day petitions, here the board was trying to balance the goal of IPRs, of course, to prevent abusive multiple filing petitions, but also applying the statute, the plain language of the statute that tells them to look at what they could raise in the IPR that reached final written decision. And so I'd say this decision is really a balance between the purpose of IPR, but applying the statutory language, which also does not require petitioners to do the unreasonable. So yes, they knew about this ground. Could they have raised it in the IPR reaching final written decision? Other than consolidation, which was not argued before the board, we have not heard of why or how they could have raised it in this IPR reaching final written decision. With respect to the whims of the board, I would just respectfully say that there's many reasons that the order of a proceeding can change. It is up to the petitioner, of course, to manage their proceedings. And be aware of the idea that estoppel can happen. What the board has done to hopefully make this more of a unique scenario is that they have passed in 2019 the trial practice guide, which eliminates the scenario where you have all of these multiple different petitions. Now petitioners have to rank their petitions. They have to persuade the board why they should institute more than one. And therefore, this scenario should not happen again. This should be a unique scenario. And the difference between this and intuitive, which is where there were same-day petitions and the board found estoppel, is that in the intuitive case, there were no other barriers to raising it in the IPR that reached final written decision. Here, the board found that barriers existed. Qualcomm has not disputed that those were barriers to raising it in that final written decision. And so that is the difference between the intuitive case and here. And, you know, respectfully, the statute is written to have this type of factual analysis with respect to reasonably could have raised. It's the same type of analysis that is done under the skilled searcher test. In the district courts, they frequently are looking at whether a skilled searcher could have found the reference. And so
Is it the government's position that the estoppel applies upon the issuance of the final written decision?
Yes, Your Honor. We did not brief that in this case, but I would say I would direct you to take a look. We did brief this very thoroughly in another appeal, which was BTG appeal number 2019-1147, ECF number 123. That sets forth the government's opinion and argument regarding the plain language of the statute says the estoppel applies on a final written decision. And with respect to Your Honor's question about the Vernetics v. Apple case, that is distinguishable because that was pre-AIA estoppel under Section 317 that talked about a final determination. And when writing the AIA law, Congress chose final written decision rather than final determination, making that distinction.
Let me just understand your point from your brief. Which side were you taking in terms of estoppel?
We are supporting the board's decision that estoppel did not apply, but our main point is that the plain language of the estoppel, the actual statutory interpretation, is not limited to just a knowledge test. It is looking at whether you reasonably could have raised in the IPR reaching final written decision.
So are you changing your position?
No, Your Honor, we're not. We're saying estoppel, it can be triggered by a final written decision. There is no estoppel that was triggered by this final written decision.
Well, it sounds like you would like two bites at the apple here.
I'm sorry if I'm being unclear. I was answering Your Honor's question about when estoppel is triggered apart from this case. So the actual triggering is final written decision. Was that triggered here? Our answer has always been and is now still no. I can go on further if that is unclear about the distinction between the two that I'm trying to make.
Any more questions, Ms. Kaler?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Right. Mr. Mayor Goins, you have your rebuttal time on the cross appeal.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Just three quick points. Any omission that I may have made regarding when I was speaking of the statute, that was inadvertent, but it doesn't change the outcome here. Second, the director is talking about unique facts or unique circumstances, but there's no exception within Section 315(e)(1) to unique facts or unique circumstances. And in an analogous context, in Windy City v. Facebook, this court acknowledged that it was faced with unique circumstances or unique facts regarding joinder, but it did not redefine or reapply or graft in a different standard or test than was otherwise required by the plain language of the statute. The last point, Intel, on these facts, there's no dispute that Intel could have reasonably raised the grounds. They were aware of the art was IPR eligible. They were not precluded by any time bar or anything else from raising it. They could have reasonably raised it. With that, we ask that this court affirm or otherwise dismiss Apple as a party to these appeals.
Okay. Any more questions from the panel for anybody?
No.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you all. The case is taken under submission.